Ireland has a very small population that is growing and is likely to continue to grow into the future. Air travel is one of the most important ways that we can access both family, but also bringing goods into the country. I mean, Dublin Airport, we had an economic analysis recently carried out soon, and we, from the traffic that we bring in and out of Dublin Airport, it looks like we support or facilitate about 116,000 jobs in Ireland alone. So for me, this was actually an area of really critical national importance, that we made sure that we had a viable airport into the future that was able to thrive through this sustainability transition, because to me, that's what it's going to look like. We're not going to suddenly stop having aviation or suddenly stop having airports in existence around the world, but there is going to be a transition that's going to be challenging for some airports or for some people. From a consumption perspective, I think we all need to think about our consumption, but I think it's the right thing to support growth at Dublin Airport. We're very, very much aligned on that.
Welcome to Sustainability in the Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to sustainable aviation. I'm your host, Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simply Flying. Every Thursday, I have important conversations with top aviation executives, technology entrepreneurs, and policymakers helping aviation take climate action. Conversations that help separate the signal from the noise. Whether you are a frequent flyer or an airline executive, if you care about sustainability or simply love traveling, welcome aboard. This season of Sustainability in the Air is brought to you by Travelport. Travelport is a global technology firm that powers bookings for hundreds of thousands of travel suppliers worldwide. The company's travel retailing marketplace, Travelport Plus, helps retailers understand and communicate the most sustainable options. When it comes to sustainability in travel, it can be difficult for travelers and agents to identify which flights, routes, and accommodations are the greenest. That's why Travelport empowers its agents to operate as modern retailers of sustainable travel, giving them the ability to access consistent emissions data using the travel impact model. Travelport is also exploring solutions to help travel retailers offer carbon compensation and nature regeneration to their customers. My guest today is Andrea Carroll. Andrea is the Group Head of Sustainability at DAA, Dublin Airport Authority. While you might think that Dublin Airport Authority, or DAA, only operates the Irish airport, it actually operates a lot of airports from Asia Pacific to the Middle East, like the Red Sea Global Airport. You may have recalled this from my previous interview with the CEO, John Pagano, of Red Sea Global as well. Andrea brings a career full of sustainability roles and sustainability education to DAA. Previously, she was head of global sustainability at Amazon Web Services, and before that worked with the Irish government as well. She brings a refreshing perspective into how airports can look at sustainability, both from a community engagement perspective, and she does not shy away from questions about scope 3 emissions, which often account for airline emissions. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Andrea as much as I had fun recording it. Andrea, for those who are unaware, DAA, or Dublin Airport Authority, is best known as the operator of, I believe, Ireland's two busiest airports, Dublin and Cork. But few know that you operate airports around the world, as far as Saudi Arabia. Can you tell us a little about DAA and your role at the airport?
Sure. So DAA is a global airport and retail travel operator. So we run Dublin and Cork airports, so they would be... Yeah, certainly what we'd be best known for. DAA did previously stand for Dublin Airport Authority, so we're very connected to Dublin Airport, and now doesn't stand that because the group has widened so much. So we actually have presence in about 16 different countries at this point, including airports, as you referenced, in the Middle East, in Canada, in APAC, and all across Europe. So yeah, really diverse organization.
Wow, I had no idea. For example, which airports do you run in Canada or APAC?
So we run the retail element of those. So we have a very strong retail element called ARI, and we run the retail element in Halifax, Montreal, Winnipeg. I think there's a number of different locations there. And then we also have an airport management and consulting arm called DAI. And within that arm of the business, we run the Red Sea Airport, which I know you've spoken to the CEO of the Red Sea Operations, yes. And Jeddah, Riyadh. There's a number of different airports in the Middle East that we would run some element or have investments in some element of. We also have investments in Cyprus and Dusseldorf as well. So a really interesting or global organization.
Indeed, very, very global, beyond, you know, just Dublin and Cork, which is where we're starting. Of course, you are
leading... Which keeps us very busy in itself.
Exactly. You're of course, leading sustainability at DAA. And before this, you were with Amazon leading sustainability. Mm-hmm. And I believe you've been with DAA for a couple of years. Yep. What's been the biggest change for you personally? And what does this role entail?
Sure. So my role is group head of sustainability here at DAA. So I would work a lot with the operations teams within our airport, specifically within Dublin and Cork, in terms, I suppose, driving climate and environmental sustainability agenda. I do kind of dip into the wider ESG and sustainability reporting elements of what we do as well. But as you are well aware, and anybody listening to this podcast is aware, the environmental and climate aspects of aviation are huge and a massive challenge for people to get behind. So I guess I've been with DAA about 2 years at this point, and came in really to drive the climate and environmental agenda within DAA, specifically at our airports, but then also wider within the group. I was with Amazon prior to that. I've actually been in sustainability for a very long time at this point, much longer than it was exciting or interesting to talk about.
That is refreshing. But I was with
So I was with AWS, so Amazon Web Services, prior to this. So I do kind of liken, although they don't seem like they're very connected, I do kind of liken the fact that they're two very large, heavy industries that have very similar challenges in a lot of ways. Data centers are massive energy users, and it's going to be really difficult to decarbonize them. Not as complex as the aviation industry, but in some ways very similar. So I was a global sustainability lead for them there, and I've worked with them for government on sustainability issues for the last almost 20 years.
Right. Now, previously on the show, I've had Luis Felipe, who is the Director General of ACI World. I've had Paul Griffiths, the CEO of Dubai Airport. And they have shared their visions for sustainability at the airports. Now, you've set rather ambitious targets. I mean, the DAA group will be a net zero business by 2050. And specifically for Dublin Airport, I believe you will be reducing carbon and energy usage by 51% by 2030 compared to 2018. Yep. How do you intend to get there? What does it take to make DAA net zero by 2050 and Dublin Airport to reduce its energy use by 51%?
I mean, I would love to tell you that I have it all mapped out and I know exactly how we're going to get there and what the next 25 years or ish are going to look like. Unfortunately, I don't think anybody has that answer now, and we're all kind of muddling through. What I've learned over the last 20 years in this area is that you have to be able to adapt, and it's very fast moving and a changing space. And that's quite exciting because I think the rapid adjustment of changes that I've seen more recently is really incredible and interesting to watch. Some people ask me, do I not get frustrated with how slowly we're moving on sustainability? Actually, no, at this point, I'm very excited. There was a long time, 10 years ago, that I was speaking to people about these topics that nobody really wanted to talk about. And now everybody wants to talk about it. CEOs, boards, whatever level you're at, everybody has an interest in it. So yeah, I'd love to give you a nice neat package of how we're going to get to net zero. All I know is that we absolutely are. Our intention is to do it primarily without offsets. That's a big driver for me, that we should be planning first to make the changes that we need to make within the business without the use of offsets. That's not to say that I don't believe in the use of offsets. I absolutely do, but they should be the icing on the cake as opposed to embedded within the plans or the structures that you're developing. So yeah, we have set some targets for Dublin Airport specifically, which drive us towards 2030. So they're a 51% energy and carbon reduction, and then also some energy efficiency targets as well. These align with the public sector targets in Ireland. So it's quite, like, the government is quite progressive here in Ireland in terms of driving us towards meeting these targets. So we've aligned our infrastructure with that. So if you understand, I suppose, and I'm sure this audience do understand the difference between scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions, a lot of those targets would relate to our scope 1 and 2 emissions. So within our infrastructure and what we can control. So a lot of that is going to fall down to the very smart engineering people that understand, I suppose, how to shift the technology within our buildings, within our campus and our infrastructure. And I suppose what I'm interested in then is how do we address scope 3 emissions within the industry? So my team is kind of looking at that macro level challenge that we have to get to net zero, what that looks like across our whole business, our whole group, and how we start engaging on scope 3 emissions.
You mentioned scope 3. That's a conversation many airports shy away from. Scope 3, for those who are not aware, in an airport's case, are emissions from airlines that are flying in and out of an airport. Those are emissions, well, I would say those are the highest form of emissions if you look at scope 1, 2, or 3. But the one that you probably have least control over as well, you can't choose which aircraft is flying to a Dublin airport or a Cork airport. You can't choose, you can't enforce SAF requirements, but I wonder whether you can. So how do you address scope 3 emissions, or at least influence?
So right now, I suppose we're trying to address scope 3 emissions by developing, I suppose, very specific partnerships and relationships in terms of working with them. Because as you very rightly addressed, scope 3 emissions, I think, are at last count about 92% of DAA's overall emissions, but we have absolutely none of them within our control. So we are very much trying to work with the airlines, work with the ground handlers, work with all the different stakeholders that have a role in operating and functioning at the airport that would influence the choices that are made. Also, surface access is a really big issue that we're trying to get a handle on now, because a lot of the choices, I suppose, we're trying to be respectful of the fact that there's choices that we make now that will allow our stakeholders, so airlines, ground handlers, busing providers and transport providers, to make better, more sustainable choices in future. But if we don't make those decisions early, then they may not be able to make that as easily in future. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation there, in that nobody has full control over this right now, but we all have to start making some small steps forward. So a lot of it really right now is about conversations, understanding technology, making sure that we understand what the requirements of our business will be in future. So I think we'll probably discuss SAF and alternative fueling. I'm really interested in what the alternative fueling landscape will look like at airports in future. I think SAF gets a huge amount of the conversation, but actually what I'm trying to get our business to understand is that the airport of the future is going to be managing multiple different types of fuels for multiple different types of transport coming onto the campus. It's not only about what's happening in the air, it's also about what's happening on the ground. And to me, that might look like SAF, electricity, fossil fuels, and hydrogen at the same time, which is a huge shift from what we're dealing with now. So trying to map that out, I think, is going to help us address scope 3 emissions as much as possible.
Well, that is interesting. I've known of airports looking at only hydrogen, and let's say, Bristol Airport partnering with Eindhoven, for example, to do a hydrogen pair, or Christchurch and Queensland, I believe, in New Zealand. I've known of airports trying to build an electric infrastructure, but this is a first that I'm hearing, an airport looking at a diversified, electric hydrogen SAF strategy. When you bring this up to the DAA CEO or the board, what's the response like? What kind of questions do you get?
Yeah, I think everybody has a question coming from whatever their perspective is, so their understanding, or what they particularly own within the airport. So if you're in charge of airlines, or you're working with the airlines, it's very difficult to imagine a future where we're going to have hydrogen planes coming in, or electric flight coming in. That future is coming pretty quickly, and I can see that getting faster sooner. But I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that we not only have to support aviation, we also have to support hydrogen buses, HVO buses, electrified buses that may want to charge at our campus. We have to support people being able to walk and cycle to our campus as well. So it's really trying to think of the full gamut of what we're going to have to support and what the next 20 years are going to look like. As I referred back to, nobody has a plan. We all talk as if there are plans there. They're not. We have to be able to adapt to change. So thinking this through, there are a certain level, I suppose, of businesses that are going to have to hedge their bets a little bit sooner, or are taking steps to make decisions, I suppose, or to hedge their bets on what they want to support. So the likes of SAF, I know a lot of airports are starting to maybe incentivize SAF directly. I don't necessarily think that that's the way that is appropriate for us. Ireland is very has a very specific need to support aviation, because we're an island and because economically we're so dependent on it. It's not like mainland Europe or even the UK. You're lucky to be connected to mainland Europe by a train line, so you have a choice. We don't really have any other choice apart from to make sure that we can support aviation in our country. Shipping is the only other way that you can get in and out of Ireland. So for me, it's about making sure that we're very clear on what the future is going to look like, what might be required of us, and maybe not hedging our bets too soon in order to be able to support the industry as it develops.
Are you able to share what's been the response, let's say, with your anchor tenant, which is Aer Lingus? Are you working in coordination with them? What are they looking at? How do you work in coordination with airlines when it comes to Scope 3? Because they probably are coming up with their own net zero plan.
Yeah. And look, that's exactly what the way that we would work with them, I suppose, is to understand what their plans say, what their needs are, and then ultimately to see what we can facilitate and how we can facilitate what they need. That doesn't mean to say that we're always going to align in terms of how we move forward. And that's, I think, the really interesting part. So I know Ryanair and Aer Lingus, who are two main carriers out of Dublin, they have very different, I suppose, approaches in terms of how they're going to address the challenges, but they also have different challenges. A lot of Aer Lingus's flights would be more long haul, and Ryanair is very short hop across Europe. So the opportunities there in terms of where they might electrify and where they might move to hydrogen are very different. So for us, well, for me, within my role in DAA, I suppose it's really to listen to them, to understand what they can support. And ultimately, right now, as it stands at Dublin Airport, we can support SAF, but we're not providing SAF necessarily because the government in Ireland doesn't provide an incentive for it. So there isn't a demand to pick up SAF right now. I do think that will change over the next couple of years. And we have, I suppose, done all the due diligence to make sure that we can provide SAF if and when the airlines are ready. So it's a matter of keeping the conversation open so that we know when it gets to that point that we all need to move into this.
Fair enough. And I appreciate you working hand in hand with the airlines flying in and out of your airports. The second part of my earlier question was, Dublin Airport reducing its own carbon and energy uses by 2030. And I believe you have three driving principles there. There's decarbonization, there's circularity, and there's healthy local environments that you're looking to do. How do these three work, tie in together?
Yeah. So look, I guess when I started with the business about 2 years ago, we had a good strategy. We had good commitments that we had made, but we really weren't sure how we were getting there and how we were consolidating all of this information. What was happening was that an awful lot of people were working, doing really good work across the business, but it was difficult to bring it together, which for me is what sustainability does. So from a decarbonization perspective, we have a solar panel farm and a significant solar panel farm that's moving into the business over the next year or two. All of that is in plan and in planning. We were looking at how we could reduce the use of fossil fuels at our campus and provide alternatives, also looking at the efficiency of, say, our boilers and the infrastructure that we have right now, because a really important tenet of sustainability is making sure that things last as long as possible. So maintaining the infrastructure that we have, it's not always about new shiny things. Sometimes it's about maximizing the efficiency that you can get from the things that you have. So I wanted to distill all of these different things that were happening into ways that were tangible for everybody, because my real ambition is for everybody across DAA to take some ownership of sustainability. People get really sick of it, but they hear me all the time saying sustainability is my job, but it's also everybody's job. Everybody should feel that they can have a role within it. So I felt that distilling things down into these three areas would be a really good way of communicating that. So if you're working on a waste project to reduce, say, liquid wastes at security, then that fits into our circularity driving principle. So if somebody wants to develop a project there or communicate in a project there, then we know how to assist or where they may need support or how that feeds into what we're trying to do. Very similar then from a decarbonization perspective, that's about both energy and carbon and climate as well, and how we're feeding into how we're understanding, I suppose, our climate requirements. And we are looking at science-based targets as well over the next couple of years. That I think that's going to be a really important way for us to understand the actual impact that our emissions reductions are having versus the theoretical impact that these changes might make. And then on healthy local environments, as I'm sure anybody in airports, I know you speak to a lot of people in airlines, but from an airport's perspective, the impact on the actual local environment is a really key issue for us. Engaging with local communities, understanding how clean or not the air quality might be, noise, water, land emissions, biodiversity issues as well. So the breadth of the issues that fall under sustainability is absolutely huge. And that's why we wanted to also create a pillar around what a healthy local environment looks like and how we can be a good neighbor in supporting us to get to there.
Thank you. Thanks for the detailed answer. I guess that's, you know, a significant part of your overall overarching strategy as well. Now, when you're trying to do so much within the organization, how do you get buy-in? How do you drive cultural change within the organization? I mean, aviation is just reeling now and recovering from the pandemic. And you've joined during the pandemic in the last two years. How do you get people on board and get participation across the different silos in the organization?
Yeah, that's definitely challenging in this role. And from my perspective, I suppose, because I've been talking about sustainability for my whole career, I'm very used to having these conversations and working to influence people when maybe this isn't the top of their agenda. And I think respecting the fact that it may not be top of their agenda, as you mentioned, I came into the business during COVID. The aviation industry had been decimated at that time. So me coming in and actually trying to talk about reductions or sustainability or whatever we needed to talk about from my perspective, then I think it was essential that I recognized what had happened to the industry during COVID, how that may or may not have produced sustainability benefits that we could capitalize on, but then also to get people to understand what this new agenda would look like, how that relates to maybe what we had experienced with COVID. So that's a really key part of what I do and where my role is. I report directly into the company secretary and I have a board subcommittee. So it's at a very senior level. But I also want to be able to connect with everybody across the business. So one of the things that I did within my first year, as well as talking to all the senior leaders on this issue, was to create what we call the sustainability ambassadors within Dublin and Cork Airport. We also do have some people from our international business as well that feed into that. And the idea there is that anybody in any part of the business who probably isn't working on sustainability and shouldn't really be working on sustainability can bring this into their role. So they got training. We then have budget so they can develop projects as well over the last year or so. So that's been really successful in terms of getting that bottom up support and from what we're doing. What I said that I wanted is that I'd like to be able to have a conversation with people without constantly explaining what scope 3 emissions are. So it was changing the level of climate literacy is what I refer to a lot within the business. So increasing the climate literacy of the business so that we can have better conversations and get quicker to the root of what the issue is. So I would refer to that as how we're working on developing our climate positive culture internally.
How do you do this teaching across the organization, for example? Do you yourself hold lectures? How is this learning going to happen across? I mean, you are invested in this work. You do this day in and day out. What about someone who's doing ops or someone who's doing airside retail? You know, the airports are complex organizations. How do you bring them up to speed?
Absolutely. So look, this is an area that I have a lot of experience in. In one of my previous roles, I worked for the Irish government and my task was to bring energy efficiency concepts to SMEs. So in Ireland, we have so small and medium businesses. So in Ireland, we have about 200,000 SMEs. And the part of the government that was doing that previously was maybe reaching about 100 people per year by doing face-to-face lectures. So I developed what we call the SCAI Energy Academy, and it's a suite of free online tools that are very easily accessible through either your phone or online. That the idea is that you can train all of your employees on whatever aspect of energy or carbon reduction or energy efficiency that that would be useful to you. That's been massively successful. Now SEI has now trained thousands of businesses on energy efficiency, and it's really raised the bar in terms of what businesses think that they can do in this space, the supports that they have access to. So I kind of took the same model and brought it here to DAA. We have 2,500 people that work for us directly, and we have nearly 20,000 people within our business. And then we have people all over the world as well. So I kind of use the same concepts. I do a certain amount of lecturing, absolutely. I don't mind doing a bit of that, but ultimately not everything needs to come from my voice. We need to hear other people. So my team have developed 3 online modules that are accessible to everybody within the business and that we share with our international partners. They're about 15 minutes long. They're very like gamified and interactive. So it's not like your standard tick a box kind of training. It's very interesting and captures the imagination, because I'm really conscious that anything that I'm doing is in addition to your own job. It's never really somebody's actual job to deliver on what I'm asking you to deliver on. So I have to make sure that people feel very bought in, make sure that they understand their role, the impact that they can have. And the online training has really helped to do that. So I think we've trained about 150 people and we have about 120 ambassadors at this point. And they're obviously in its infancy, so that's rising as well. So to me, having these tools there is really impactful for raising, as I said, that climate literacy across the business.
This is very interesting. From this ambassador's program, are there one or two initiatives that you can think of that have had a true big impact?
Yeah. So one of the things that that we looked at, or well, I didn't look at them. We gave them kind of the driving principles. So they were inspired to go back into their part of the business. And then there was somebody who was working on security, and they noticed that when it gets to security, as we all understand, everybody comes to security and they're a little bit stressed getting through the security monitors and taking off their bags and taking off their shoes. And if you have either waste or items that can't be gone through security, it was going into, it was not being recycled or not being separated out because the environment was quite rushed. So one of the projects that our ambassadors identified was quite a simple way to segregate in a very colourful and easy way, and to the training that they could give to the airport security officers to be able to segregate a bit better, to also identify where there was items that unfortunately had to be taken from people that might be reusable or in very good condition, how we can segregate that out. So it's not that all of these projects and all of these solutions from a sustainability perspective need massive technical solutions. They don't. Sometimes it really needs people who are very aware and conscious of how we're doing these things to introduce ways to work better or work in a more sustainable way. So that, I think, increased the level of security lane recycling from, I'm maybe a little bit off on the numbers here, so forgive me, but it went from a quantum of about 10% to about 70, 80% recycling on the security lanes, which was fantastic for such a challenging environment. Another thing that came from one of our ambassadors was that they identified the opportunity to replace in our heavy vehicles where there's no electrical option to change those vehicles to, that we could use hydro-treated vegetable oil as a direct insert instead of diesel, which has reduced the carbon emissions associated with our diesel heavy vehicles. So like our fire engines, snowplows, that kind of thing, by about 90% immediately. So that was a really great win again. So it's these on the ground projects that I could never come up with because I don't work in that part of the business, but having people on the ground who are thinking about them do.
Wow, this is really encouraging because now you've democratized it's not just your onus. What about this Dublin Airport Environmental Working Group? Now, this, I believe, is a working group that goes beyond just DAA. How does this work?
Yeah, so this is like a community liaison group. We have a couple of formal fora where we can bring people in from the community to make sure that they have access to the right people, that they understand what we're doing from an environmental perspective, and so that we can share environmental information with them. So it's quite an active working group. It has an external chair as well. So it's carried out in a very democratic way. And it gives us a really good insight, I suppose, into what's driving the community, what's really of concern to them, and gives them access to maybe information from an environmental perspective ahead of time, or maybe access into myself and my team to ask specific environmental questions.
That is encouraging. I love the multi-stakeholder approach, both within the organization and outside, because, you know, it's, I like to say that you can't just have a department of sustainability, just like you can't just have a department of telephones within an
Absolutely.
Organization. Everyone needs a telephone. Everyone has one. And, you know, you have to work across the organization. Airports, of course, traditionally have always sought growth. Let's build a new runway. Let's get more airlines. Airline marketing is a thing. Where every year airports go to roots conferences to attract more airlines. So airports have always been an engine of economic activity. Mm-hmm. But given that you want to be sustainable, you want to reduce your scope 2 emissions, how do you balance growth versus sustainability?
Yeah, to be honest, this is one of the reasons that I took this role. I had come from data centers, which was very much on a growth trajectory. And in some ways that felt a little bit disingenuous to me as a sustainability person and somebody who's been in this sector for so long to be driving that kind of growth. It is necessary. Our lives are online at this point, but to the level, I don't know. From an airport's perspective, I don't think it's just airports that are moving towards growth. It's the way society is set up, and it's the way that in some ways we need to be. And I was very comfortable in putting my backing and my expertise to developing a more sustainable model of growth for our airport here, because I do think that there is a level of growth that we need. Ireland has a very small population that is growing and is likely to continue to grow into the future. Air travel is one of the most important ways that we can access both family, but also bringing goods into the country. I mean, Dublin Airport, we had an economic analysis recently carried out soon, and we, from the traffic that we bring in and out of Dublin Airport, it looks like we support or facilitate about 116,000 jobs in Ireland alone. So for me, this was actually an area of really critical national importance, that we made sure that we had a viable airport into the future that was able to thrive through this sustainability transition, because to me, that's what it's going to look like. We're not going to suddenly stop having aviation or suddenly stop having airports in existence around the world, but there is going to be a transition that's going to be challenging for some airports or for some people. Look, from a consumption perspective, I think we all need to think about our consumption, but I think it's the right thing to support growth at Dublin Airport. We're very, very much aligned on that. And I think as a country, Ireland is so dependent on aviation that having the most sustainable version of that possible is a good job. Like, it gives me a lot of satisfaction to be working in this area.
Let me push you a bit harder here, Andrea.
Sure.
An airport not too far away from you, which is Schiphol, Amsterdam Schiphol. Yeah. It's, you know, there are way too many parallels here. It's an airport that supports a lot of jobs. It's national airline in KLM. Supports connectivity for the Dutch as well as people connecting mm-hmm. through Amsterdam. I believe it's more than 60% of flyers on KLM who are transiting via Amsterdam. And, you know, it's been a beacon of growth and activity all along until this year, where Schiphol Airport, together with the Dutch government, has sought to curb the growth of total movements of aircraft, primarily arguing that it's about noise abatement, but we all know it's beyond that. They are now imposing, they are now proposing a tax on transit passengers as well as not just people coming in and out of Netherlands. Sure. Do you foresee DAA ever playing that role? Or are you playing that role that, you know, you got to be the bad guy here telling airlines, listen, there's only so much you can grow? Or do you think there can be a better way here?
Yeah, so look, I do think that your example is valid in terms of what's happened there, but the direct comparison isn't correct, because there are other, Schiphol has been on a growth trajectory and a growth model, very much so as an international hub. From our perspective, we're very much focused on serving Ireland nationally. So it really isn't the same to make a direct comparison. From a growth perspective, I don't really see the two as being mutually exclusive, sustainability and growth. I do think that there are limits to growth, but there are limits to growth in every industry. And that's something that we're going to need to come to terms with over the next decade or two. I don't know what the limits to that look like for Dublin Airport, but I do know that the sustainability ambitions and targets that we've set now, we can continue to reach them. And we absolutely have to continue to try to reach them while maintaining the growth that we need. We have a passenger cap right now of about 32 million, and we are looking at what growth might look like within the next decade or so. And I think that's very important for us to do nationally. As I said, Ireland is very, very small, but very, very dependent on aviation. So, yeah, I don't necessarily think that the Schiphol model is exactly how we're going to go, but I do think they're one of the early movers here. So we kind of need to watch and see how this pans out, but it's not a direct comparison.
Fair enough. And thank you for taking that on. As well.
No problem.
Very often, this is something Dirk Singer, my head of sustainability, and I often speak about. Very often, it's the public pressure that results in governments behaving this way, because, you know, vote banks mm-hmm. and they're trying for short-term gains and swings. So definitely, there's public pressure in the Netherlands. What do you see on the ground in Ireland? To what extent are passengers from different areas of the world looking to the airport to become more sustainable? Or to what extent do you think that being a sustainable airport is even a commercial advantage?
Yeah, I think that there are different drivers there. I think that depending on the type of passenger that's coming through or the type of publicity or the initiative, that there's a lot of support there. I don't necessarily think that, I kind of think that we're in a little bit of a bounce at the moment, where we've come out of COVID. Nobody was able to travel for a very long time. And there is a bit of a bounce happening that will probably continue for a few years, where people are anxious to travel, anxious to move around. We haven't really settled into normality again. Now, that said, if we go back to what 2019 looked like, 2019 was still about at the levels that we are now. But I do think making decisions or making corporate decisions based on what we're seeing right now isn't necessarily the right way to go. We do get some feedback for sure from our passengers and really from our local communities and our employees around the sustainability requirements or what they think is important. And that feedback is incredibly important to us, because that honestly does drive the kind of changes that we make, the kind of initiatives that we'd introduce, and understanding, I suppose, what's important to our communities and our stakeholders. I don't necessarily think that, I suppose, the climate action is very strong right now in Ireland, but I do think that it's a groundswell. There's a huge amount of legislation coming in this place. And I think it's actually right that we're seeing more legislation come from the EU and in Ireland as well in this space. It shouldn't be all on people to have to make this change. Governments and businesses really need to take the lead on this. As we said early on in this interview, I've been in this space for a very long time, and there was definitely a period where the government really weren't doing anything and they were putting everything on consumers. And I don't think that's right. So personally, I'm very happy to see more legislation, more government engagement on this, as opposed to the pressure being left to people.
Thank you so much. That is so refreshing, because too often I have airlines on this show saying, oh, you know, I've put an offset button on my website, or here my passengers cannot pay for SAF. But I do believe, yes, it is the industry's responsibility to act ultimately to make sure that aviation and travel is sustainable. If we look at You alluded to this earlier, Andrea. If you look at preparing for next generation aircraft, hydrogen, electric powered, ground vehicles turning all electric, what are some of the specific initiatives you're taking at DAA to enable this?
Yeah. So we have, I mentioned HVO earlier. Heavy vehicles at an airport are a really difficult challenge. And I see HVO, so hydrotreated vegetable oil, as a really important transition fuel for us as we move away from diesel-powered vehicles to more electrified vehicles. We will, by 2025, have 100% of our light fleet on our campus as electric vehicles. So that's a huge change. Obviously, how green that is depends on how green the grid is, but the green, that's outside of our control. So we're trying to move as best as we can in that space. But that's a really big win for us. We didn't, however, want to sit back and just do nothing about heavy fleet as well while addressing light fleet. So HVO was a really good option for us. So I think by the end of this year, we're going to have maybe 60% of our heavy fleet transitioned over to HVO, and hoping to move much closer towards the 100% within the next year or so. So, but I have referenced that I see HVO as a transition fuel as opposed to the final destination, because this is because I don't really know what the final destination is going to look like. I don't know whether electric snowplows are really something that is ever going to be real, or whether we're moving towards a hydrogen future, and whether heavy vehicles then will be powered likely by hydrogen in future. But when that's going to come, I'm not sure. So we've made a lot of changes, I suppose, from a transport perspective and an on-campus vehicles perspective. We're also very heavily involved in government and policy, like policy making discussions. So I sit on the European Forum around hydrogen and aviation, advising the European Commission on what that looks like, the role that airports are going to have to play within that. And then SAF obviously is a part of that as well. That's something that we're considering right now. So
I'm curious, for the unaware, what is HVO? Is this biodiesel that goes in the ground equipment? What is HVO?
It's a biodiesel, yeah. So it's hydrotreated vegetable oil. So it's a vegetable oil, whether that's come from waste or whether that's come from a pure biofuel. And why I'm saying it's a transition fuel is because there are challenges with biofuels. We can't just rip up forests and rip up land to create biofuels. I'm sure we've all seen the stats around the requirements that it would take if we had to plant to provide the level of SAF that we need. I think you're talking about multiples of countries in order just to provide the SAF that we would need for aviation. So I don't really see biofuels as a permanent solution. I see them as part of the picture. And this is why, if we go back to my earlier comment around the future of alternative fueling, is going to use multiple different types of fuels.
Got it. No, I think that does make sense. And I appreciate you taking action, you know, doing what you can today, and then transition to something that's cleaner and greener. We've also seen some disruptive action being taken from climate change activists and protests at airports. Mm-hmm. Have you faced any of this? And if not, or if yes, how would you respond if you're in an airport facing climate action?
Yeah, look, I think that people are feeling very disempowered and very challenged by the scale of the problem. Look, I'm an environmentalist true and true. I have been thinking about this and talking about this for a long time. So I have no particular issue with climate activism. I think that it's a positive thing. Do I think that it's a positive thing when it disrupts the safety or the ability of people to be able to do their job safely or to get to their destination safely. No, I don't love that, but I do appreciate the fact that people are frustrated. So this is part of the reason why I'm so focused on open dialogue and making sure that people are informed and educated in this space, because I think that's what's going to move us forward more quickly. I do think probably in aviation, I get a little bit frustrated, to be honest, as an environmentalist about the media focus on aviation as the level, because of the level of carbon emissions that we have. It is a very high level of carbon emissions that come from aviation. But pointing the finger solely at aviation and not looking at things like fast fashion or food waste is really doing the planet a disservice, because it's not really getting to the root of what the actual issue is from a sustainability perspective. So if I'm having that discussion with somebody who's passionate about this and they ask me why I'm in this role, or what actions I'm taking. The actions I'm taking personally, I'm reducing the meat that I take. I'm looking at local options in terms of my food. I massively reduce food waste. And I'm also looking at how I can buy more secondhand clothes for my kids, these kind of things, to reduce the fast fashion. It's not as easy to quantify the impact of that, but actually it's probably more impactful than any other choice that you could make.
Do you offset your own flying?
I do not offset my flying. Yeah, I'm not a huge believer in offsetting. So as I've mentioned, I do think that there's a role for offsetting, but it's kind of the icing on the cake. I believe that other things that I'm doing in my life are the things that I believe should be done. So I've already mentioned clothes and food and these kind of things. So no, I don't. I'm very conflicted about that. And I do think about it. We do offset in DAA as part of our ACA carbon accreditation. We offset some of our scope 3 emissions and our scope 1 and 2 emissions. And when you can find a project that you believe in, I guess this is the product of me being in this industry for so long, because I was there at the beginning when offsetting was just getting going. And there was an awful lot of really poor management of money. So yeah, I'm a little bit of a skeptic there. Very happy to be proven wrong though in this space.
Right. No, and why I'm asking is because I, like you, also, you know, I've measured my own carbon footprint, and I was shocked at what percentage of my own personal carbon footprint was my flying. I am a vegan. I used to drive an electric car in London. Now I do not have a car at all. Yeah. And I believe the grid here in London is clean, at least in London. And, you know, I was just shocked that, oh my goodness, you know, there's everything else I'm doing, and then there's a flying, and it's just disproportionately contributing to my carbon footprint. And since then, I've offset almost every single one of my flights, either through SAF or through some very credible offsets. I use carbonclick.com specifically for this. So might be worth checking out.
I also try to minimize the amount of flying that I do as well. Now, whether that's I can't necessarily say that that's a virtuous thing. I also have two very small kids, so I don't necessarily want to fly all the time.
Yeah.
So I do think minimizing where you can. And look, the society has changed a lot over the last 3 years. COVID in some ways was such a blessing, and the likes of the data centers that I used to work for have provided us a lot of the alternative options to flying. So I do think that there's a bit of a balance, but I would never criticize anybody for offsetting. It's just not something personally.
Case in point being, you and I were trying to coordinate this interview to be in person here in London. Mm-hmm. In the end, you could not fly, and we're doing this virtually. So here's, you know, one flight off the books there. Now, final question. We have just 27 years to reach net zero as an industry. What gives you the most hope for the future of sustainable aviation?
To be honest, it's been fascinating coming into this industry. As I said, I've only been in aviation about 2 years, and it's not really an industry that I was very, very interested in before. So what gives me a lot of hope, I suppose, is looking at the passion of the people who are involved in this industry and the passion for them to get to the next stage of what that transition looks like. I think that there's a huge amount of people that are very dedicated to aviation and flying in the past, and now are very dedicated to what that new model looks like. So the change that I've seen, even in the 2 years that I've been involved, is rapid. So if we take that and push that out exponentially, it's incredibly exciting. It's a really exciting industry to be in, and it gives me a lot of optimism and hope for the future. But I am an alternative forever optimist, for sure.
We are in the same boat there. Now, Andrea, if you have heard this podcast before, the last part of this interview is what I call the rapid fire round, in which we get to know you a bit more personally. And I'll start simple. What's your favorite movie?
Yeah, this was a bit I was looking forward to the least, I have to say, to be honest. So let me think. What's my favorite movie? I really love The Terminator. That's probably my
favorite movie. Wow, you're an Arnie fan. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, more a Linda Hamilton fan. I think she was an incredible role model in the 80s for women.
Okay.
And the concept of the Terminator and AI, I'm not a very early adopter of technology, and I do think that the Terminator probably influenced that quite a lot.
Okay, your favorite book?
My favorite book is one called Wild Swans, which is about the Mao dynasty in China and how it was told from the perspective of two sisters and how that effectively changed the lives of generations. It was an eye-opener. I think I read it when I was quite young, and it was an eye-opener to me about politics and culture and how that can negatively influence the world that we live in.
I was not familiar with that book. I will definitely be checking it out. Thank you for telling me about it. What's your favorite airline?
Oh, this is like choosing between my babies. So I've had some thoughts about this. I don't think I can. I mean, if you look at both Aer Lingus and Ryanair, they've been so integral to how Ireland has grown, the difference mm-hmm. that I've seen in the economy in the Ireland that I grew up with and the Ireland that is now. So unfortunately, I will stick with saying both.
All right. Well, I'm not sure too many people will say favorite airline as Ryanair, but here it is what it is. What about your favorite city?
I do love Dublin. Yeah, it's an amazing city, and I'm a really big advocate of, often people will move here and say they've never come here or they've never visited before and they love it. And I have nothing bad to say about it. I think it's a beautiful city, full of history, really nice people, great food, completely underestimated in what we do. So big advocate for Dublin. People should come.
Okay. I have to tell you that my two daughters' favorite city right now is Dublin, even though they have never been.
Really?
And that's because they're singing this song all day long. That sometimes I even dream about, which is in Dublin, fair city.
Oh, Molly
where
Malone.
The girls are so... yes. And they keep thinking, we have to go see the Molly Malone statue. And it's like, yes, one day when we get to Dublin, we will definitely go and see it.
Oh, you do.
You know, that's, that's their favorite
city.
And I cannot get that song out of my head somehow. Andrea, what is something that you want to learn?
I speak really poor Spanish. I lived in Spain when I was young, and I lived with a family. I spoke no Spanish and they spoke no English. So we spoke terrible Spanish together. Well, I spoke the terrible Spanish, they spoke the terrible English. And it's never really improved since then. So it's definitely on my list when I have a bit of spare time to keep working on my Spanish, keep improving that.
Wow. Okay. Languages is definitely something high on the list for many people. What are you doing in your free time?
I spend a lot of time with my kids. They are my priority for sure. But as a family, we actually took up martial arts a couple of years ago, which is hilarious for me. It's not something that I ever did. But my boys all do jiu-jitsu and MMA. And now I do MMA and a little bit of jiu-jitsu as well. So we spend an awful lot of time in the gym together. But it's a great thing to do as a family. Yeah.
Not sure if too many families can say that.
There you go. That's what we do to get our stress out. It's a really great stress reliever.
Right. What's the best advice you've ever received?
The best advice I ever received, I think it was like to do what you enjoy. Like, so to go to college or to study something that you enjoy. But I would say the caveat on that, because we hear that a lot, the caveat on that is you still need to work hard in it. Just because you enjoy it doesn't mean that you don't work hard. Sometimes because it's something that you enjoy, you work too hard in it. And I think that's what I've felt in this space. It's kept me very, I always was interested in geography and environmental activism. So I did relevant courses in college, but I also then continue to work very, very hard in everything I do. And I still live and breathe this stuff now.
Wow, fantastic. And final question. If you were on an 18-hour long haul flight to somewhere, let's say, from Dublin, might be Singapore or Sydney, who would you love as your seatmate?
I'm going to give you a very personal answer and say my husband, because I don't get to spend enough time with him. And 18 hours would seem like an amazing thing to do. Outside of that, though, maybe Hillary Clinton. I think she's an incredible woman. Even if you don't agree with her politics, the things that she has achieved in her life, I would love to hear about her life story.
Well, I do wish you a flight with both of them, hopefully one day. and with your husband, sans the kids, I'm guessing. Otherwise, you'll be rather busy on that 18-hour
flight. Exactly. Without the kids, that was the caveat for sure.
All right, Andrea, I really appreciate your frank answers, your thoughts. It's always good to speak to someone who is a practitioner in sustainability, and you're new to airports and, you know, and aviation, and that's refreshing. So I do wish you all the best in all the endeavors. We will be watching closely, and thank you once again.
Thank you. And thank you so much for the invitation. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sustainability in the Air. Aviation is one of the hardest to decarbonize industries, yet there are multiple paths to get to net zero. Awareness is key to a green future. So please give us your support to help our sustainable aviation insights reach a wider audience. You can do this by sharing this episode on your network, on LinkedIn, Twitter, or even WhatsApp. Or perhaps you might consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to this episode. You can start a conversation with us by writing to us at podcast@simplifying.com. And for more content on sustainable aviation, please visit our website, green.simplifying.com, and join the movement. Sustainability in the Air is an original podcast by Simplifying. The show is produced by Juraj Toth in Slovakia. Dirk Singer is our Director of Sustainability, who leads research for each interviewee out of Greenwich, UK. Shubhadeep Pal is our supervising editor based out of Mumbai and Singapore. The articles are written by Ayushi Badola in Dehradun in India and Meera Hull in Montreal, Quebec. Creative design is led by Ligia Esteve in Montreal. Baiba Dreamen is the project director for the show based out of Valencia, Spain. Special thanks to Wendy Sim in Singapore. And I'm Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simplifying and your host. Please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn.